Welcome to The Audible, presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined as always by Bruce Feldman. We've had a little bit of distance now from the national championship game. Bruce, you've mostly been focused on the coaching carousel, which, knock on wood, is winding down.
Almost, Stu. The head coaching carousel, we're taping this on Wednesday, and late last night on the West Coast, way West Coast, Todd Graham got back in the coaching business, and that was the last head coaching hire. But there's still a lot of coordinator moves, a bunch of other assistant stuff that I think will be going on for probably the next couple of weeks. So that is keeping some of us pretty busy. But yeah, it's time to take stock in as what we're going to do on the podcast today. Now that we think all the head coaching vacancies in FBS are filled, it's time to get our thoughts on the hires we really liked and the hires we are a little bit skeptical of.
So in the end, there were 22 FBS head coaching jobs that turned over. That seems like a fairly normal number. All right, well, like you said, why don't we start it out with this. 22 of the 22 hires, which one do you think was the best hire?
The hire that I like the most, actually, I'm going to give you one is a sitting head coach and one is a first-time head coach. The sitting head coach hire I like the most is actually Nick Rolovich at Washington State. Here's why. I think he was going to leave. He's going to take and fill big shoes in Mike Leach. Big personality, made Wazoo nationally relevant. A really good offensive coach, obviously. Here comes Nick Rolovich. He's probably as close to Leach without being Leach or Dana Holgorsen as you're going to get. He's a very colorful character, as people on the West Coast have started to get to know. He is a great eye for talent. I've said this before, where he was the first one to offer Keaton Slovis, the first one to offer Justin Herbert, also one of the first ones to offer Sam Darnold. He knows the junior college recruiting scene really well. I think that is important, especially at Wazoo. And you know what? He did a really good job at a really tough place with no resources at Hawaii. So I really like that hire. On the flip side, the hire that I like for the first time head coach is Jeff Hafley at BC. We had him on the Audible a couple of weeks ago. We've talked about him before, what he did as a defensive coordinator for Ohio State. I just think he has a rep as a great recruiter, especially in the New Jersey area when he was at Pitt for our buddy Dave Wannstedt. I think he makes a lot of sense for BC for what they need. I really think those were two home run hires. What about you?
Yeah, I like both of them a lot. I think Nick Rolovich is not somebody I necessarily thought of for Washington State ahead of time, but once it happened, it was like, oh yeah, that makes total sense. I saw he already did an impromptu meet and greet at a bar in Seattle with Washington State fans. We mentioned it on the last podcast. That's kind of the personality that he is, and I think he'll do very well there. It's hard for me to, this may seem too obvious, but I think the home run hire is actually Greg Schiano, because there's literally nobody else Rutgers could have hired, save for maybe Nick Saban or Dabo Swinney, that would give you any confidence, any certainty that Rutgers could get this thing turned around, because they are starting from such the bottom basement place. And I mean, look, we've spent a lot of time in the last few, people are constantly suggesting that the Big Ten should kick Rutgers out, that they're so non-competitive and they're so hopeless. And this is the one person who gives them legit reason for hope, because he's done it before. He's won there. He's recruited exceptionally well there in the past. And people seem excited, genuinely excited for the future of Rutgers football. And he's truly the only one that could have made that happen, and obviously it almost fell apart. So another one I would just point to real quick, I think Florida State did very well getting Mike Norvell. I think he's got, he fits the profile. I mean, obviously not every successful Group of Five coach necessarily becomes a successful Power Five head coach, but I think the fact that it wasn't just 1 year, that he, you know, he was building toward this New Year's Six run for a few seasons there. He produced very exciting offenses. at Memphis. Now he's going to Florida State, which has the ability to recruit, obviously, top of the level, top of the sport, has before, has won national championships. I think he'll get it going there. I actually said in my written mailbag today, somebody asked, of these three, Dave Aranda at Baylor, Mike Leach at Mississippi State, and Norvell, which one do you think will get his school to a New Year's Six Bowl first? And I said Norvell. It's probably not going to happen this coming year, but I think it could happen fairly quickly after that.
Two quick things I wanted to bounce off you. If I say to you, of those 22, which was the most underwhelming? And I know you're probably going to have a column about where you grade, and I imagine you will have some D grades in there. What would be the D grade for you?
Well, we've brought this up before on the podcast, so it's almost like rehashing it. Because I think we're both going to say Steve Adazio at Colorado State. That makes no sense to me. So should I give an alternate answer?
Yeah, I would. I mean, you're right about that, but yes, give. I'd be curious what your other takeaway now would be.
With a little bit of distance, I'm going to go with Eli Drinkwitz at Missouri. I think that was a what's the way to put it? That was a very surface level hire. That was, oh, look, he got Appalachian State. They were top 25 team this year. They beat two Power 5 teams. Let's go get that guy. He's the hot Group of 5 guy. But in reality, it was one season. He inherited a very good situation from Scott Satterfield, who did a great job building up that program. And then you go looking at his resume before that. He's got this reputation as like an offensive savant. And I'm like, where is this coming from? He coached Ryan Finley. Congratulations on that. But he, in his years as an OC, and there haven't even been that many, Boise State, NC State, none of those offenses were ranked particularly high. So I feel like it's one job above where he should necessarily be going. And they ended up in a bidding war for him with Arkansas. So I don't have an obvious name for you who Missouri should have hired instead, but I think that's a huge investment in a guy who's relatively unproven.
Okay. I'm going to ask you this one.
You got to give me your underwhelming one.
What's that?
You got to give me your underwhelming one.
Stu, I'm going to go with a familiar name. I just thought, and again, maybe this is relative to what we're dealing with here, but I don't know. I mean, when I heard Todd Graham is getting back in it, you know, he had some success at Arizona State, but I don't know. I just thought that was kind of, it screamed retread to me. I get it. It's a really, really tough job, and there were guys who were backing out of it. But I think from going from Nick Rolovich to him, I think you're going to lose some momentum. Now, I could be proven wrong. Maybe Nick Rolovich left some players behind. Todd Graham will win 9 games, and then he'll build off it. But I'm just not seeing it.
Todd Graham is one of those guys who keeps getting jobs, and you're like, why? Now, he does have, Arizona State fans don't, like, they remember him fairly fondly. They don't feel like...
Well, he also donated some money to the stadium renovation. Yeah.
This is now his 5th head coaching job since 2006. 2 of them he stayed at for one season. He doesn't have the greatest reputation as, like, a people person, people that have been around him. I guess what I'd ask you is, how did they even... It's funny because literally a week or, like, 10 days ago at the hospitality room in the hotel in New Orleans, this literally came up like, oh, yeah, what happened to Todd Graham? He's disappeared off the face of the earth in the last 2 years. Boom, he's the head coach of Hawaii. Like, what's the connection there? How did they even come to him?
A bunch of guys started to, this probably was the search itself where some of these guys – whether it was Robert and I or a few other guys who were candidates, I think just didn't wow anybody. And they kind of, from what I'm told, Todd Graham at one point mentioned, hey, there was the opportunity maybe to bring Chip Long, who's still getting paid by Notre Dame, to bring him back on his staff to help run the offense. And I guess he is a recognizable name. I don't know. I think this speaks to, and if you know somebody who's worked at Hawaii, they will tell you how tough of a job that is. Yes, it looks like it's football in paradise, but just you have no money and no resources to operate a program with. And so look, maybe Todd Graham, because I don't see Todd Graham taking a program and going 3-9, 3-9, 3-9, but it just kind of seemed like an underwhelming hire. Again, I wouldn't give that as a D or an F, but just in terms of when I thought of the term underwhelming. Because when I look at some of the other guys who've gotten hired at places, you know, I'll rattle off some of these quick. You know, Dave Aranda, I think that was an interesting hire. I think, you know, I think he's ready to be a head coach. Kalen DeBoer was really successful in the short time in Indiana as an OC, and I thought he did really he did a great job at a small school before that as a head coach. Ryan Silverfield from Memphis, I think that's will be a really good hire. You mentioned Drinkwitz. I like the Danny Gonzalez fit at New Mexico. Again, that's another place that didn't have a lot. I think Ricky Ronnie was a good hire for ODU. Let me ask you this one.
You're going pretty deep in the woods here.
I'm going to go into the woods.
Deep in the weeds.
Deep into the weeds on one that's a recognizable name. What did you think, because I don't think we've talked about this, was Brady Hoke is now a head coach again and again at San Diego State.
Yeah, it's bizarre, to say the least. Just everything about, I mean, Rocky Long stepping down ostensibly to become a DC, but that hasn't happened yet. As far as I know, he's not a college DC yet.
No, I'm not sure how serious that is.
Brady Hoke got fired from, I believe, 4 straight jobs, and some of it was just wrong place, wrong time, but like he resurfaces as a D-line coach at San Diego State, and 1 year later, he's the head coach. I know that they were decent the first time he was there, but that was the that was a long time ago, before the Michigan stint, before obviously a bunch of jobs since then. So that's a hard job. I wish him luck at there. I don't think Rocky Long, what he accomplished there, was appreciated enough. You know, for a program that's you know, plays at this old stadium in front of sparse crowds often, and is definitely an afterthought in that part of the country relative to obviously the Pac-12 schools. You know, he was winning 10, 11 games almost every year towards the end there, and obviously produced a great tree of running backs. Now, 2 of the most high-profile hires that we haven't mentioned yet were both in the same state. Ole Miss hiring Lane Kiffin, Mississippi State hiring Mike Leach. I'm going to put you on the spot here. 3 years from now, which one is considered the more successful hire?
It's weird to say this, but Leach is the more conservative hire. Just because of Lane's nature, you know, like it wouldn't surprise me if Lane stirred it up, and because he's had that before, you know, his time last time in the SEC as a head coach was very volatile. I think he has learned from that, but I don't know. This is probably not the answer you want, but I'm not sure either guy is going to have either program in the top 15 consistently. I just don't know if I buy that.
Consistently, I don't know that either of those schools has ever been in the top 15.
They haven't. That's what they're up against.
Maybe Ole Miss in the Archie Manning days, but I don't think that's the bar they're going to be measured by. I think Ole Miss got a taste of that with Hugh Freeze. They beat Alabama 2 years in a row. I think that they're hoping Lane can recreate that. And then with Mississippi State, they got a taste under Dan Mullen of being in the mix nationally. Obviously, that year that they rose up to number one, they didn't finish. I'm not even sure they finished in the top 10 that year, but that was a great season. And then he got them used to being 7-8 win team. And with Moorhead, it wasn't like they were that far off of that. I just think that Dan Mullen had raised the bar to the point where Moorhead was considered disappointing.
So are you saying
I have more confidence in Kiffin of the two. I think that, I mean, Mississippi State is a hard place to recruit to. It's a hard job where you're going to be at a talent disadvantage to most of the schools you face in your SEC schedule. Now, Dan Mullen did a good job of, first of all, finding some of the, I mean, they produced quite a few NFL players, especially on defense, finding those guys who weren't necessarily five-star recruits.
Well, they also got some of those.
They got Jeffrey Simmons, yeah.
Yeah, they did get some of those five-star battles with Ole Miss, so it's not like
but
they were
Leach,
all off the radar.
I think
guys,
you would agree, is not known as a recruiter. He's going to try to he's going to get that quarterback. He's going to find that quarterback that nobody had an eye on and turn him into a 5,000-yard passer. And I don't know. I don't know if that's going to work. It reminds me a little bit of Brett Bielema going to Arkansas and thinking that he could just take the Wisconsin system and plop it down in the SEC West, and you find out real quickly, like, nope. You got to have guys to beat Alabama, LSU, and Auburn, the teams in that conference that recruit very well. Now, Kiffin can recruit, and Kiffin has run some very innovative offenses over the last however many years. He was part of Saban's staff. He knows that division. So I think if you're talking just football, I think he could actually do pretty well there. The question is he going to torpedo that with some of his off-the-field shenanigans that just and headlines that just never seem, he can never, either he never seems to be able to avoid or he brings them upon himself. But from a football standpoint, I have more confidence in him. My last category I want to bring up, under-the-radar guy who you think could be sneaky good. Like, you know, not Mike Leach or Lane Kiffin, less obvious name who you're like, I think he could sneak up on people.
I think it's going to be Ryan Silverfield at Memphis. That'll be the one.
Gotcha.
Have heard really good things about him from people inside of coaching. And that program right now, it's like kind of an incubator in terms of they've been really good for a while. I think they're going to be terrific this year. Brady White is back. Well, I'm already saying this year, but this is, you know, this coming year. Brady White is back. They got a ton of skill guys. I think he will be a guy that will be at a much bigger power, at a big Power Five job 2 years from now. I think he will go on that fast. So really good offensive line guy, good teacher, knows how to develop people. He was a guy a lot of people have tried to hire away from Memphis. I think he will do really well there. And then I think he's going to have some big opportunities in the not-too-distant future. How about you?
I'm going to go with Jeff Scott at USF, who is really only the, if you think of it, only the second coach off the Dabo. You know, with all the success Dabo has had at Clemson, you would think people would be jumping to hire all of his assistant coaches, and that really hasn't been the case. There's a lot of loyalty there that's maybe unusual.
And there's really the one
coaches.
Guy really didn't thrive, obviously,
no,
after that.
Chad Morris, yeah. But Jeff Scott has been there, was there throughout the whole run. You know, he was, I think Chad Morris was probably there 3 or 4 years. Jeff Scott was there throughout the whole run. He will probably model his program very much after Clemson, and he's at a place. USF's definitely struggled the last couple of years under Charlie Strong, but they're not that far removed from Quentin Flowers, and I think they won 11 games, either one or both of his last 2 years. I'm old enough to remember when they got to number two in the country under
that
Jim
was,
Lovett.
By the way, that was two jobs ago for Willie Taggart.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think, you know, it's obviously great recruiting area, and he has experience recruiting in that state. His dad was at FSU for a long time. I believe he's coming with him, so... I agree with everything you said about Silverfield. That's a little bit more of a ready-made situation. But I think Jeff Scott could definitely build USF up.
The crazy, every year, Stu, there is one nutty coaching search. There was one this year. At least it finished with a bang.
Was this the Tennessee coaching search of this year?
I don't know if it's the Tennessee thing was a soap opera for like, felt like a month. This was just a crazy photo finish, and I'm going to tell you what it is, and you go, oh, yeah. It's not even an – it's an FCS job.
Jeez. How on earth – okay, go ahead.
So it involved the Bobby Petrino hire.
Oh, right. How could we have not brought that up yet?
So what was crazy was – so it got reported – locally that Bobby Petrino was going to be the new head coach at Missouri State. But then nationally, the Football Scoop site said that a different guy was going to get announced. How do you think that... I mean, do you buy the theory that this...
Do you want to specify which different guy?
Yes, Art Briles.
Yeah.
Do you buy the theory that there was some kind of PR strategy, in quotes, say, all right, We're gonna get ripped for hiring Bobby Petrino, a guy who's had more than one scandal around him.
Gosh, I don't know. You know, you are somebody who prides yourself on you're only gonna report something if it's 100% accurate, even if that means you miss a couple scoops along the way or you're not the first one to get it. Not everybody on the internet operates that way. People throw stuff out there that's not real or not finished or whatever. I mean, when this seems to be an extreme case, and that others reported that Art Briles never even talked to him for that job. So yes, the theory you're floating that Somebody put that out there just so Bobby Petrino wouldn't seem so bad. It's possible. I'm just continue to be bewildered. Like, how could anybody look at Bobby Petrino's track record and go, you know what? This is the guy for our program. Now, if history repeats itself, and by the way, it has repeated itself like five times by now, he'll have success there, especially on offense. He's not going to produce a Heisman winner at Missouri State, but something similar to that. And then the program will just absolutely implode because he can't recruit and people don't want to work for him. So your staff, you know, becomes a shell of itself. It's just, it's going to end very badly. Pat Forty, who lives in Louisville, who is part of the Yahoo Sports podcast, said at some point, fall.
Do you not even want to acknowledge where Pat Forty now writes? Or you just kind of...
SI, they say it right on the podcast. SI is Pat Forty. Oh, okay. But the time he made this comment, he was Yahoo's Pat Forty. This was when, if you remember, Bobby Petrino spoke at like the Little Rock Touchdown Club and was actually pretty well received. I think he's still pretty popular there. And apologized, made a point of apologizing to everybody there for what happened at Arkansas. And as Pat said, every Bobby Petrino coaching tenure ends with an apology. So we'll see. We'll see what causes that at Missouri State. Speaking of coaching activity, well, let's check in real quick on the national champs. They've had quite the last LSU's had quite the last 10 days or so between visiting the White House, having a parade, having a mass exodus of guys turning pro, and then now having lost both Joe Brady. He wasn't the OC, but the passing game coordinator, the guy who is largely credited with their remarkable transformation last year. And now Dave Aranda, great DC, who got the head coaching job at Baylor. Good for him. You're plugged in as anybody with LSU. How do you think Coach O is going to go about that? Those two very important hires?
Just from talking to him, I don't think he's going to rush into anything right away. Obviously, Steve Ensminger is still there. He's the primary play caller on offense. But I think he's going to look and say, okay, you know, we have a system that, you know, we've developed, not just obviously with Joe on offense, but their offensive line coach as well as Ensminger, and say, okay, how can we kind of add to this? Because certainly, you know, the biggest piece of this wasn't an underclassman. He wasn't a coach. It was Joe Burrow, and he's moving on. So you lose that trigger man. So I think I'm interested to see what they want to add to this LSU offense. On the defensive side of the ball, we'll see. I know there's a bunch of guys he has talked about privately about saying, oh, this is somebody I'm interested in. But I think it's going to come back to, you know, how does this guy fit in with what we do? In terms of defense, they lost some really good players. They should be really good on defense. I mean, their defensive line probably should be every bit as good, if not better. And although they lost Grant Delpit early to the NFL, the secondary, the best player in the secondary was a freshman. He's back, and they have a lot of really good young talent there. And Jacoby Stevens is safety. He opted to stay. So I think the area where they got to, you know, patch up more is at linebacker. But I think that the, you know, I would imagine he will have at least one of these hires within the next like 3 or 4 days. I don't know how quickly both hires will get done, but I think it's a situation where I think he's going to look and say, okay, what is the best thing for us going forward? What can we add to this as much as anything else? That's kind of his long view. And keep in mind, Dave Aranda was making $2.5 million. That's a lot of money to play with to try to recruit somebody, maybe a sitting defensive coordinator from someplace else to come to the SEC.
Back to the pod in just a minute. I want to tell you about Robinhood. With Robinhood, you can invest in stocks, options, and ETFs right from your phone. You can even spend and earn interest on uninvested cash. And with fractional shares, you can buy stocks in any amount, including companies like Apple, Amazon, and Tesla, for as little as $1. And that's with no commission fees or account minimums. So whether you're new to investing and ready to learn, or just looking for a better experience, stop waiting and join the 10 million Robinhood users. Listeners can get started with a free stock by going to theaudible.robinhood.com. That's theaudible.robinhood.com. All investments involve risk. This is not an investment advice, a recommendation, or a solicitation of any security. Other fees may apply. The free stock program is subject to certain limitations. Annual percentage yields on uninvested cash is paid by program banks and is variable. Robinhood Financial is not a bank. Now back to the podcast. By the way, I should mention, we talked about all these head coaching changes. There's obviously been a lot of coordinator hirings. And I think the most significant one, Joe Moorhead. You know, Oregon needed an OC. They go and get, of all people, Joe Moorhead, who had tremendous success as the OC at Penn State, is, you know, you think Joe Brady, who's one of his mentors, Joe Moorhead. In fact, a lot of young coaches out there consider him a mentor. And now he's going to go to Oregon and work with some very talented players. Obviously, they need to develop a new quarterback. I think of all the guys they could have gotten, that was an absolute home run hire for Mario Cristobal.
Yeah, and we'll see, because, I mean, obviously they got to get better in the pass game there. And I think that's one of the challenges that Joe Moorhead has gotten. And so we'll see if they can do that there. They should be really, really good on defense. And they still have C.J. Verdell came back. Obviously, they'll have the best offensive lineman in the country in Penei Sewell. But, you know, look, his reputation is sterling, especially from what he did at Penn State. So Oregon's got it rolling right now.
Okay, and I also wanted to bring up a school near and dear to your heart, Miami, who is coming off a bit of a debacle of a season in Manny Diaz's debut. You know, not just the record, but you can't be going losing to FIU and then getting shut out by Louisiana Tech in your bowl game. But they're having quite the offseason so far on the grad transfer, the transfer portal, but specifically grad transfer. So D'Arc King, Houston quarterback, was a big story last year when he shut it down after four games and redshirted. The reason given at the time was like Dana Holgorsen wanted to save him for this coming year. Well, he decided to go in the portal. He goes to Miami, which desperately needed an upgraded quarterback. And then on that same day that he committed to them, they get Quincy Roche, defensive end from Temple, who was only the AAC Defensive Player of the Year last season. 13 sacks, that's number 7 in the country. That's quite an addition as well. Should Miami fans get their hopes up now, or is this too many years in a row of getting your hopes up and having them squashed?
I would say don't get your hopes too high on D'Arc King and the offense. Now, what I do think is interesting is they could have the nastiest pass rush in the country coming up, because Quincy's a big time difference maker. You add him to Greg Rousseau, who's arguably the best freshman defensive lineman in the country, was really disruptive. You have those two. And then the guy people, I think, forgot about is Jalen Phillips, who's been sitting out from UCLA. And we'll know more about what his frame of mind is and where he's at after spring ball. But Jalen Phillips is as freaky as any defensive lineman in college football. If he's ready, you put those three guys along with Scott Patchen still there, that's reason to be optimistic, at least on that side of the ball. With D'Arc King, the part that I would say pumped the brakes on a little bit was he had one terrific season. You know, I don't know what you know. Again, it's a grad transfer. Sometimes these work out great. Sometimes they kind of get underwhelming, and I don't know if, you know, I think he'll be the best thing they got. I don't know if I would expect him to be the guy who lit a lot of people up in the AAC in 2018.
I'm a little surprised to hear you say that, because he was the Kyler Murray of the Group of Five that year. He was that good. He got injured, and I think he only played in 11 games. He got hurt mid-November. But his stats that year were still pretty incredible. Now, he did not get off to a great start those first four games of 2019. It's hard to say how much of that was him, how much of that was a new coach and a new scheme and Dana Holgorsen. He lost a bunch of his, you know, the top skill players around him from the year before. But he doesn't need to be Kyler Murray. They that position, you know, whatever you want to say about Manny Diaz, and a lot of people have already thrown in the towel on him. Quarterback, he did not create the quarterback, mass quarterback shortage there, where, you know, going back to Mark Richt's last season, or I would actually say going back to whenever after Brad Kaya left, it's just been dismal quarterback play, and they've run through several different guys. So he is, if nothing else, an upgrade from what they've had there before.
No, I'm agreeing with you on that part. I just don't. At this point, I get a little cautious on the grad transfer front. And again, you know, there's been some transfers, certainly. You know, I wouldn't put Justin Fields in there because he was not a grad transfer. But, like, there was Joe Burrow, Jalen Hurts. Jalen Hurts was a much more established guy. The part, again, that gives me a little bit more pause. Again, I think he'll be good, and I think he is an upgrade. But, again, it was he had one terrific year. The other times he was there, I'm not, you know, again, I'm a little more cautious on it, I guess.
Fair enough. It's been, I think, a few weeks since we've been able to do the mailbags. We had the live episode in New Orleans and then obviously the one right after the game. So let's see what's been sitting in our inbox. And you can send your questions, as always, to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. This first one is actually something that Andy Staples and I think were talking about in New Orleans. There might have been somebody else involved in this conversation. We were lamenting that the Bengals are going to ruin Joe Burrow's career. Josh Fiery from Elk City, Oklahoma. Hey, Bruce and Stu. Love the show. I have a quick question for you about Joe Burrow and his draft position. I don't actually know how Eli Manning did it, but I've always heard that he and his dad manipulated the Chargers and forced his way onto the Giants. That is true. Is there any way Burrow could pull an Eli Manning and strong-arm his way onto a better team? Why don't more players follow Manning's lead and play for better teams? I'm all for it. I think he should anything to get away from that franchise he should do, but I'm also told that that's not all that realistic anymore.
Yeah, I think it's a big leverage ploy if you're going to do that. You need a lot of stuff to line up to do that. I mean, certainly John Elway, I think, had that situation. He had baseball to help him with leverage a little bit.
But what was Eli Manning? He did not have baseball. His leverage was basically just who his dad was. My recollection of it was basically just his dad is such a big deal, he was able to strong-arm it into happening.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I remember it being. Again, and it's like, if somebody doesn't want to play for you, I think it's one of those things where you're like, okay, do we want somebody who's going to be there? Now, certainly in the case of that, there was other alternatives for the Chargers at that point.
Two things. To be clear, Joe Burrow is from Ohio. I don't think he's going to try to force himself away from the Bengals. But also the big change, and Andy brought this up, that needs to be acknowledged here, is the rookie the big change in the rookie contracts. You know, when this would have come up with Eli Manning and all the way up until, I want to say, 2011, you know, every draft pick had kind of an open-ended negotiation over his contract. And so if you really wanted to force somebody's hand, you could just say, I'm not gonna sign that. I'm not gonna agree to those terms. But now it's slotted by pick pretty much. So there's no real leverage there to say that contract's not good enough for me. The rules basically say what you're allowed to offer them, right?
This question from Caleb in Grand Island, Nebraska. My question stems from Stu's article about little old Clemson. What would it take for a team such as Clemson to break through to be considered a quote-unquote blue blood? On one hand, they have been dominant. On the other hand, they've been dominant for all of 5 or 6 years. Conversely, what would it take for a team such as Nebraska to lose their blue blood status, assuming they haven't already?
Yeah, I hate to break it to Caleb, but I don't think, I mean, Nebraska is a blue blood historically, but I don't think they're viewed as.
How do you define blue blood? Maybe we should start with that, Stu.
Yeah, I think blue blood is, it can be used in a couple of different ways. I mean, obviously, if you're just talking about blue blood as in kind of old money, yes, Nebraska is that, Notre Dame is that, etc. I look at it more as, and I do this column every few years about who are the kings of the sport, who are the kind of dozen or so teams that have the most powerful brands. And that's important to note. It's not so much like, hey, let's look up who has the best all-time winning percentages. Like, who are the big national brands? And I don't think Nebraska's viewed that way anymore. I don't think Tennessee's viewed that way anymore, whereas they would have been 20 years ago. But a good example of what he's talking about, like what does it take to break through? I think we would all agree LSU is in that group. But they wouldn't have been prior to 2003, you know, for probably 3 or 4 decades. I mean, LSU's entire football history was basically that 1 year with Billy Cannon. But now they've won 3 national titles under Three different coaches, actually. Saban, Miles, and now Ogeron. And there's no question.
Clemson is one of those, right?
You would consider them a blue blood, if that's what...
So tell me you're 12 now.
I can't do that off the top of my head. Okay. Clemson, the thing with Clemson is they are absolutely, obviously, one of the top programs in the sport right now, if not the top program in the sport. But what he's referring to is the article I wrote about Little Old Clemson, which is, despite that, despite being as dominant as you can be the last 5 or 6 years, they have yet to, like, they don't play in the game, the highly rated TV games. They don't get talked about endlessly.
So you're looking at it from, like, a Derek Crocker perspective.
Yeah. They don't get talked about endlessly in the media the way Alabama does, the way, I mean, who do you think has gotten more coverage over the last 5 years, national coverage, Clemson or Michigan?
Michigan, but also some of that has to do with who the head coach is now, too.
It has to do
Jim
with
Harbaugh
that.
Jim Harbaugh is very polarizing. Let me finish on this one, though.
Yeah.
But Jim Harbaugh is a very polarizing figure. He is a big personality who was really successful when he came in there, and he did a bunch of stuff that either stepped on people's toes or pushed boundaries, whether it was trips to, you know, that Sports Center and Marty Smith are going to Rome or France or wherever they went. So he did a lot of stuff that I think raised their visibility. Whereas if you look at Clemson, I'm not saying this is a significant piece of this, but like for much of the football season, if not all of it, Clemson has no, you know, their players and coaches aren't even on social media to kind of tap into that. So I think there is that piece of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's the fact that they're playing in the ACC in games against teams that nobody cares about. But it's also, like I said in the article, they're a relatively small school in a tiny town. They don't have the massive national alumni base that Michigan has or Ohio State has. So you can't do much more than what they've already done. And I think they're probably only a couple more years away of this sustained. I mean, if they come back next year and win the national championship, end of story, right? How can you not say they're
how similar is Clemson to Auburn to you?
I think they used to be, well, from a like an institutional standpoint, they're very similar. A famous columnist in the South once said that, you know, Clemson is basically Auburn with a lake. They're both like these schools in these tiny towns, kind of isolated from major media markets. But Auburn has never, I mean, Auburn has won national championships, but Auburn's never had a sustained run. In fact, they've always been very inconsistent. They've never had a sustained run like Clemson's having right now with Dabo. And I think a couple more years of this, and it's all about how do you, it's hard to completely transform your brand in this sport, right? Like Notre Dame has had this brand for 100 years, Ohio State, Michigan, Alabama, like they built this up over 70, 80, 90, 100 years. But Florida State didn't have a brand before Bobby Bowden. Miami didn't have a brand before Howard Schnellenberger. You know, you can transform yourself. In fact, a good modern example is Oregon. Younger people aren't going to remember this, but Oregon, complete non-factor in the Pac-10 or even nationally. I would say certainly up until they went to the Rose Bowl against Penn State in 94, but where it really took off, I think, was with Joey Harrington and the billboard and Nike, and they just basically, a lot of people who have no connection to Oregon became Oregon fans because of the offense or the uniforms. And I think that's probably happening with Clemson right now. I would imagine younger fans who aren't as caught up on or hung up on who was good 20 years ago are seeing Deshaun Watson, Trevor Lawrence, Travis Etienne, who, by the way, surprised us all by announcing he's coming back next year. That's what the Bulls, the Jordan Bulls were to some people in the 90s. Like Clemson is that now for a younger generation of college football fans. So all that is a long way of saying I think they're almost all the way there to being considered a blue blood.
I feel like they're already there. I feel like they are already a blue blood.
When they're pulling the TV numbers of some of those other schools, they will be a full-on blue blood. But there's certainly, whenever I next do my list of kings of the sport, they will certainly be in it.
Well, you know, one of the things that I think hurts them, Stu, is what you said before. It's hard to pull big TV numbers when you're going to play teams that you're going to beat by 4 touchdowns.
Well, and then when you're not playing, LSU's playing Alabama, like they're playing programs or opponents that people care about and are interested in, and that's not the case.
Right. LSU's not going to pull big TV numbers when they play Utah State.
No, of course not.
Or something.
And the ACC wasn't always this bad. I mean, people have such short memories. We're only a few years removed from them having Lamar Jackson. You know, when Clemson played Louisville in prime time, and it was Deshaun Watson against Lamar Jackson, like, that pulled a huge TV number. They just don't have an adversary like that right now. You know, if Florida State can get it going again, or if Louisville gets it going, then you're going to see more interest in their regular season games. And obviously, if Texas A&M had been better, then that early season game last year would have been a bigger deal. Chad Justice, Raleigh, North Carolina. Bruce and Stu, it's been a rough go recently for the Pac-12. An early peek at next year's schedule looks like it could be disastrous for the Pac-12, with early season games including Oregon against Ohio State, Oregon State at Oklahoma State, USC versus Alabama and Notre Dame, and Washington hosting Michigan. The Pac-12 is likely to be underdogs against all five teams. If they were to lose these five games as expected, is the Pac-12 season over before it even begins?
It feels like that. The biggest one to me is that Oregon-Ohio State game. I don't think Jonathan Smith's team against Oklahoma State is one people are setting their calendars on, but Oregon with their five-star recruiting, and now Joe Moorhead's there to help run the offense against an Ohio State team that's going to be top five, maybe even number two in the country, I think. That'll be a huge headline game. Certainly USC and Alabama will be a headline game for some of that, but to me, it's Oregon, Ohio State. Now, if USC somehow beats Alabama, then I feel like it's you have basically two shots here to get it right. Because Washington beating Michigan, I don't think people look at Michigan as being that team at this point. They're not going to see it that way. Alabama and Ohio State, I think those are probably going to be two of the top three teams in the country. That's where I think they got to do some business.
It seems like every year they have one of those. It was Auburn-Washington. It was Auburn-Oregon.
But those aren't even as big as these two opponents. Auburn wasn't a top three team going into that game.
No, I mean, this is Ohio State. This is reigning playoff team, Justin Fields. This is a huge game. I mean, it's even bigger than, you remember Oregon and Michigan State had a series a few years ago, and it seemed like those were really big games. That's nothing compared to the hype that will go into this one. So I don't think there's any shame in them losing it, but that's just, it's a great opportunity. All right, again, send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. We could really use them this time of year as great conversation fodder. And we'll see you next time. If you enjoy The Audible, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review and a rating if you could, too. It helps us get the word out. Our producer is John Hayes. Our theme song is Dangerous by Kevin and the Octaves. You can download their music on Spotify or Apple Music. Follow me on Twitter at SL Mandel. Follow Bruce at Bruce Feldman CFB. And if you're not yet a subscriber to The Athletic, what are you waiting for? You can get 40% off an annual subscription by using this link, theathletic.com/theaudible. That's 40% off your subscription to The Athletic. Jump out of place, throw our money in the New York Stock Exchange.